Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
In August, Norwegians bought just 30 gas cars. And I just can't wait until we finally get the version of this podcast where we interview the last guy who buys a gas car in Norway.
Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin.
And I'm Mac Hogan.
On this week's show, Range Rover has finally revealed its first EV, which has been years in the making. Nissan is scrambling to sell hybrids, and it's not the only one. And a new EV battery degradation study has clear winners and losers.
Yeah, so let's get into it. And we'll start with the Range Rover, which we finally have details about.
Yeah, this has been, as long as I've been doing this, basically, I think there has been talk of a Range Rover electric. They announced this thing like 5 years ago.
Yeah. And we already had a drive of the prototype like over a year ago. It's been a long process. We talked recently on the pod about them pushing back the Defender. There is now a Range Rover Sport EV coming as well, a Range Rover GT EV as well, but this is the Range Rover. And I will say, in general, probably the most confusing brand for the average person to understand in terms of how many times I get, wait, is it a Land Cruiser or a Land Rover, a Range Rover? So just to be clear, Range Rover is the flagship product of Land Rover. So this is the Land Rover, Range Rover EV. So this is the 2027 Land Rover Range Rover Electric, starts at $140,000, including destination, and offers 333 miles of range. It's an 800-volt platform, 118.5 kilowatt hours of battery, but it just kind of looks like a gas Range Rover. You wouldn't really know that there's like an 800-volt EV that charges from 10 to 80% in 22 minutes there.
Not kind of. It literally looks exactly like a gas Range Rover. There's nothing different about it.
Is not a problem. We should be. I mean, of all the things Range Rover does right and wrong, I think everyone agrees that the design is usually pretty fantastic. This one's got about 8 inches of ground clearance, so it's decent, though not incredible. It offers the world's first electrostatic speakers, so super high-end audio. It's like a $12,000 package. It's got in-house design motors, batteries, thermal management. This is their big, like, okay, we're doing it for real. So what do you think about it, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually really know what electrostatic speakers are. But I do know that Suvroth, who on our staff went to England and drove the Range Rover and spent time with it, like, can't stop talking about how amazing they were. So maybe it is worth the, it's like a $12,000 stereo package. So maybe it is actually worth it. I think like you said, I think that going with the tried and true design, I think Range Rovers look amazing. Like they kind of always have had this classic boxy, you know, SUV look, even now a little bit more rounded, but they just look amazing. So I think it was the right move for them not to try to go some kind of like weird futuristic route with it. It's funny that, you know, Jaguar is the same company, right? Jaguar Land Rover. And so Jaguar is going the full direction, right? Like they have completely thrown the brand in the garbage, starting over with a totally new design, going all EV with this Grand Tour that, like, we saw the preview of it a while ago, looks completely insane compared to regular Jaguars. So it's funny to see the completely opposite ends of the spectrum for EVs in the same company.
Yes and no, right? So this is the first one. Range Rover is also doing the Range Rover GT, which is on a more bespoke EV platform, software-defined vehicle, going to look a little different. There is sort of a limitation of how many ways you can make these giant off-road crossovers look. I think you're starting to see a lot of cheaper EVs and cheaper SUVs look like Range Rovers. That's not a coincidence. Like, there's only so much you can do with the restrained design. But I agree with you. This product is really interesting, how they've put it within the brand. Because number one, yes, it's the same design. And number two, it's kind of the same pricing and specs in a weird way. So the base model one starts about $25,000 less, but that's like the six-cylinder one. The V8 version, which has a little bit less power, a decent amount less torque, but kind of similar, is pretty much the same price. They both start at $138,000 before destination. And, you know, the V8 is powerful. It has like, I think, 523 horsepower or something. But the V or the EV has 542 horsepower, 627 pound-feet of torque, 0 to 60 in like 4.6. So it's interesting that they've positioned it right next to their traditional bread and butter gas powered V8 one. That's the Range Rover. You know, a lot of the ones you've seen in your life are V8 normal ones. And now they're saying, okay, the electric one is not this like crazy added cost on top of that. It's, you get a base level of performance. And if you want to go above that, you can then pick, do you want that to be electric or gas? And I think that's probably going to be a better strategy than what a lot of companies have done. We've criticized a lot in the past of companies that have been like, you know, I kind of pick on them a little bit, but like Ford with the Lightning, right? Like, why are you going to buy a car that looks identical and kind of does the same stuff, but a little bit worse at the towing and then $15,000, $20,000 more expensive? You're not going to be able to sell it within your dealership, let alone conquesting versus Ram and Chevy buyers. So I think this is a smart first move.
Yeah, I think if you are going to go that route, doing it with a luxury car will work better, just because somebody already considering like a $120,000, $130,000 car is going to be less sensitive if the EV version costs 10 or 20 grand more. Like, they might actually be the people who will go for that. But yeah, agreed. I think this is a good move. I think it's tailor-made for like rich, you know, Californians who already have a garage, they can charge. They probably have other cars. So the Range Rover makes perfect sense as an EV. I think in terms of the EV specs, it's like good, but not great. I think 333 miles of EPA range, decent for a big boxy car, but also falling behind a little bit of the kind of, you know, the vanguard of these new luxury EVs, Volvo, you know, EX60, which is smaller, BMW, Porsche, they're all kind of pushing 400 miles now. So 333, it strikes me as a little bit behind the times. Charging is really strong. I think 350 kilowatts is still very good, 10 to 80% in 22 minutes. Like, that's gonna impress people. And I think that's going to be a thing where people, you know, that can sell a person who is not super jazzed on EVs to be like, 22 minutes, that's not bad.
As we talked about with like iX3 versus R2, real consumers in the real world aren't looking at a big list of all the specs of all the EVs out there and picking off a menu, right?
Yeah.
I think with range, a huge question is it enough? And I think for the average LA or New York dwelling Range Rover owner, who almost always is going to be someone who owns their own home anyways, is someone who's probably flying on family vacations, not doing huge road trips, all of these things that sort of point you towards an EV. I think Range Rover has always carved out a niche, not as the most, you know, they've never had a car that's faster than the fastest Cayenne or, you know, has all of the gadgets maybe that a Mercedes GLS does. But they do this sort of refined off-roading thing. That's always been, you know, that's where they kind of got their start. And, you know, 8 inches of ground clearance isn't crazy, but Land Rover has always pushed the limits of what traction control computers can do, what the programs within the car, the terrain select system, all of those things have always been really big strong points for Land Rover. Suvroth came away really impressed by the off-roading experience in it. So I'm pretty interested in that. I know, as with the normal Range Rover, most of the customers aren't probably going to use that. But like with a G-Wagon, like with a Wrangler, that capability, that vibe that it can do incredible things matters to the customers. I think it puts forward a certain image that if you're spending 140 grand on a car, again, matters to you. And so I think it's a niche for sure. Range Rover is its own thing. Everyone knows what a Range Rover is, although they confuse it with Land Rovers and Land Cruisers, whatever. But yeah, I think it's got a real shot to sell outside the specs on just the phenomenal design and what I assume will be great driving dynamics. But we'll have to see when we actually get to drive the thing in the real world, not just you know, on their short little test circuit.
Yeah, agreed. Shall we talk about Nissan?
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Yeah, let's do it. So I wanted to talk about Nissan for a couple of things. The first of which is the story we got from Automotive News. It was Erk Vach talking about the Rogue Hybrid and the company's race to get e-Power out the door. So you read it as well. Why don't you tell us sort of the basics of what happened?
Yeah, this was interesting kind of in the context of there are a lot of companies that have ended up on the back foot in in hybrids, which are super popular now. Nissan is one of them. The company reportedly pulled forward the launch of the Rogue Hybrid twice now. It is now launching at the end of 2026, which is coming up. That's like basically right now, albeit in very limited volumes. I think the more interesting thing is what sort of hybrid this is, because we've mentioned it on the show before when they revealed it, but this isn't just a regular hybrid. You, Mac, you've talked to their executives about this, and you've actually driven this type of powertrain from Nissan.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so the system is called e-Power, and you're right, it's not a traditional hybrid. They talked about it. I went to Japan and their headquarters, I think it was spring of 2025, talk about their reinvention plans. And part of it that's funny, they've showed us some products that are heavily under embargo that then ended up canceled anyway. But they were talking about, you know, how they're going to revamp the business. And one of the things that one of the executives, Pons Panda Kathura, said to me, he's the senior vice president, chief product and planning officer for Nissan Americas, was like, man, we've been caught without hybrids. They did hybrids at one point. There was a Rogue hybrid. There was an Altima hybrid. But right now, basically, there's nothing except for a Mitsubishi Outlander-based Rogue plug-in hybrid that was pulled forward as a stopgap until this Nissan-developed e-Power system comes out. But the key thing you need to know about e-Power is it's almost like the non-plug-in hybrid version of an e-Rev, in that there is no connection between the engine and the wheels mechanically. So all of the power is generated by the electric motors. The gas engine only powers the generator system that then charges the battery. So it's a very weird system, and it's simpler than a traditional hybrid, kind of, but there's all kinds of weird things going on with it. So they say it drives like an EV, and it kind of does when you're in normal throttle conditions. However, if you really rev it hard, like if you really are getting onto a highway or something, when you accelerate, there's a weird thing where the battery is small because it's a non-plug-in hybrid. So it doesn't immediately have enough power to provide you its peak power, because its peak power only comes when the engine and the battery are both putting current into the motors. And so you have a weird thing where it drives kind of like an EV most of the time under low throttle conditions. But then if you accelerate really hard, you'll get one wave of torque and then you wait for the engine to rev up and then get the other. So it's just very different than what other people are doing with hybrids. Again, no transmission, nothing like that. But yeah, they've never brought it here before.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Yeah. So you'd have to ask Nissan to get the official answer. I have a suspicion that I've seen other people share as well. A big part of it is that because you're doing this sort of double conversion, there's kind of an inherent trade-off there. Nissan's not the only one that's ever thought about saying, well, why do we deal with the transmission and the blending the power? Wouldn't it just be simpler if it was all electric motors?
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, for sustained cruising at high speed, an electric motor being fed by a gas engine that's just generating power for it, you're now converting the rotational energy of the engine into electricity so that it can go into the battery and then can be converted back into rotation. So that double conversion is less efficient. There's no way around that. And so companies like Honda and even Chevy with the original Volt, which people think is an EREV but kind of isn't, they put something where basically the engine can clutch directly to the wheels at high speeds through a reduction gear. And so you don't have a multi-speed transmission, but when you're doing those really long highway cruises, like 70, you know, miles an hour, you're getting direct power to the wheels from the engine rather than it all routing through the electric system. Nissan does not have that. And so my suspicion is that this system is going to perform a lot worse on the highways in terms of efficiency than something like a Toyota system that's using the engine and the electric motors together and switching between them as is optimal, or the Honda system that is effectively Nissan e-Power up until highway speeds, and then it clutches in and becomes more fuel efficient. Now, Nissan has said they expect it, the Rogue, to be more efficient than the CR-V and about the same as the RAV4, but it's unclear what numbers they're referencing, whether that's highway, city. I would expect this to be awesome in the city. European, Japanese reviews have always given it really high praise, and maybe not as fit for long, sustained highway. I think it'll still be very efficient, probably more than a pure gas vehicle. But if you had to pin me down, I would guess that that's why it was not here to begin with, because we're such a highway country.
Because you drove it in a different, in not the Rogue, in something
else. It was in the Qashqai. Yeah.
Feel meaningfully, like, could you tell the difference between that and a regular like Toyota hybrid? Does it feel different when you're driving around? Because you still have like kind of electric feel and the sound maybe of, you know, the noise and the vibration of gas.
Yeah, Nissan tried to pitch it as it feels like driving an EV, and that's not true. There are parts of it that do. It's like if you've driven a Civic Hybrid, that kind of feels like an EV if you don't drive EVs, you know? And if you do drive EVs, the waiting and the noise and things kind of cue you in. So I would say the Toyota system, you can kind of feel the blending a little more, and you can watch as revs fall and how it directly affects the wheels. Whereas the Nissan, what you're hearing and what you're feeling don't always go together, but that fundamental experience of having an engine that you can hear working hard when you're working it hard is still there. And I find, you know, it's a 1.5 liter three cylinder. That's what the CR-V has now. That RAV4 hybrid's a lot bigger engine. And I'll tell you, when I was going like 70 miles per hour up a steep grade in the CR-V hybrid, you know, 1.5 liter three cylinder is a small engine for something so large and heavy, and you can feel it working. So I think the Rogue will be better than a gas engine in terms of how loud it is, how hard it's working, all that. But fundamentally, when you're not when you don't have a plug anyway, you're just moving energy around the board as much as you can. And I don't think they have the most efficient solution. But if you don't want to use Toyota's patents or whoever's going to sell them to you, the external company that Toyota uses, I think this works. And most importantly, they already have it. Because let's talk about this for a second. All of these companies that have sort of missed the boat on hybrids, you know, something you brought up at the top. And I think this is something we've been talking about for a while, where if you don't have a hybrid on sale now and you're watching Toyota and Kia throw giant numbers at the sales charts, you're probably thinking like, God, we got to rush to develop a hybrid. But you're running into that problem of it takes a normal automaker 4 to 6 years to develop a powertrain. So by the time that your system comes out, you know, what's hybrid demand going to look like in 2032? You know, at that point, do you want EVs? And that's why a lot of companies didn't have them. And I think Nissan has neither the time nor the budget to develop a different system.
A new one,
Right. And so I think this is a good fit for, you know, having a hybrid option at their stores is going to help them, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And just to speak a little bit to the, you know, the kind of divergence between hybrids and EVs right now, you know, as EVs, like if you look at the sales charts, EVs over the last couple of years, it's up and down and essentially mostly down lately. Hybrids over the last few years have just rocketed up as, you know, a share of the US market. Back in like 2023, 2024, they were basically neck and neck, which is kind of hard to imagine given where it is right now, where last quarter, EVs were about 6% of the US market. That's kind of where they've been hanging out since the tax credit went away. Mm-hmm. Hybrids are 16% of the US market. A lot of that has to do with, like you said, Toyota making the RAV4 hybrid only, making the Camry hybrid only. That's just like hundreds of thousands of automatic.
Honda making the top trims of CRV Accord. There's a lot of things like that where, or Sienna's only have it. So many things like that where imagine seeing that in the EV world. Obviously, the price comparison is not the same at this point. But just like, yeah, when you take America's best-selling sedan, the Camry, and make it a hybrid, and then you take America's best-selling SUV, and then you make it a hybrid only, wouldn't you believe it? Hybrid sales go up. But it shows there's not much of a downside to having one around, right? And I think that is something a lot of companies like Ford, you know, Ford's had a lot of success with the Maverick Hybrid. They're expanding how much availability there is for all-wheel drive, the max tow package. But across the street, you know, GM, very little hybrids at stake in the game. Stellantis had plug-in hybrids that they were having some sales success with, but maybe some technical challenge with, and now they only have the Jeep Cherokee, which is kind of using a similar system to what's in Toyota's. So there's a lot of people that misplace their bets. I always think about Acura telling me probably a decade ago they were going to skip hybrids and go straight to electrification, even though they had already made at this time the NSX hybrid, they had made the MDX a hybrid, and then they killed both of those. And now they have nothing, even though Honda has some of the most hybrid sales in the US. And so timing this market has just been unbelievably challenging for everyone. But I think now getting it out fast was the right call for Nissan, because now the Rogue's going to be here and there will be another option, and they're just, people want them.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing with, like GM, like opposite from Ford, GM skipped out. They were like, we're going to skip over hybrids, essentially. Yep. They had the Volt and they were like, we're going to skip over hybrids. We're going to go straight to EV. Then a couple of years ago, as EV sales were looking a little bit shakier, right? Mary Barra on an earnings call was like, actually, we're going to invest in plug-in hybrids. We still don't actually know what, I don't think we know what is coming to the US of that.
Yeah.
But they're looking at hybrids. Volkswagen also, they're one of the original like pivot to EVs, right? Mm-hmm. Car companies. They don't have any hybrids in the US. They're working really hard to try to get a couple here. They're building up those supply chains, but they're not here yet. So it's interesting to see that. And this was not the only Nissan news, right? We have, you know, the Nissan Honda merger fell through rather spectacularly last year, but now they're actually going to work together on some stuff. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so if they've talked about publicly a couple times now, they're exploring collaboration in a bunch of ways, but this feels like the first big news we have, where they said on Monday they've entered into a joint development agreement to standardize core electronic control units, ECUs, vehicle operating systems, middleware, and vehicle control software for future vehicles. So specifically, they're talking about like the zonal architecture and the operating system that all runs on, like, is going to be standardized between them.
Yeah. This feels like kind of a big deal. These are the computers that run, you know, modern cars, that run software-defined vehicles. And it's them basically saying that, like, you know, they're going to work together to make not just some like regular components, but to kind of lay the groundwork for these vehicles of the future.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. It's like, you know, Dell and HP deciding like, oh, we're only ever going to use the same processors and the same software that goes on it or whatever. And so the rest of the experience then has to be controlled from there. And I think this is something where we've seen both companies struggle, in that Nissan doesn't really have an SDV effort, a software-defined vehicle effort that we're aware of that's near. But Honda got presumably close to launching its Zero Series, which was supposed to be a whole new zonal, you know, software-defined vehicle stack, and that didn't really happen. And so they canceled that. They pushed it back. We're not sure what else is coming. Now these two companies are working together on it. And yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because it really ties their fates together, right? If you're doing the core computing system together, that constrains you in specific ways. And I think it's something we've never seen them tie themselves together in this way. So even though it's not a merger, it's a lot closer than they've been in the past.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I guess you could see it as there are companies that share platforms and you end up with different looking vehicles on top of the same sort of skateboard or the same chassis. So I don't doubt that they can make cars that look and feel and drive differently, even with this, even with the same ECUs and control software and whatever. I think what's especially interesting is, like, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense because this is an expensive endeavor. These are, this is where cars are going. This is where Tesla and Rivian and Chinese companies and increasingly others are becoming really competitive in terms of, like, offering really amazing software features, offering really deep software upgrades. And at the same time, Honda and Nissan have been struggling, right, to meet this moment. Like, Honda's in a much better position, I think, than Nissan. Honda posted its first annual loss as a public company this year because of kind of rewriting its whole EV strategy. It also specifically said that it's been hard to compete with fast-moving, high-tech Chinese companies. And then Nissan has just been, like, on the struggle bus for years and years. It's been hit particularly hard in China, and globally its sales have fallen 6 out of the last 7 fiscal years. So I think it makes a lot of sense basically for these two to come together, share some of these development costs, try to make this go along faster, and, you know, put out some more competitive products, especially in China.
Yeah, and even outside the global perspective you brought in, which I think is spot on, and something both companies have talked about a lot. You know, Nissan's also talking about trying to figure out a China strategy, whether it comes to working with its local partners to export more to Southeast Asia from its Chinese factories, things like this. But also, just in the local angle, Subaru, Mazda, and Toyota have all kind of tied together in certain ways, right? The Toyota is licensing the hybrid tech for the CX-50 to Mazda, and then they're building the CHR and the Uncharted and the Trail Seeker and all those things together. And so you're kind of seeing Japan's auto industry kind of collapse into two, you know, alliances isn't the right word, groups isn't the right word, but I don't know what the right word is. But there's sort of a degree to which these larger competitors like Honda and Nissan, Toyota's not going to directly work with them, right? They're competitors. But also, they can't survive if Toyota is helping the two smaller Japanese automakers and not them. So I don't think that the Honda-Nissan tie-up has always been an obvious fit. I think culturally, there's a struggle there. Both of the companies kind of want to see themselves as maybe more important to the partnership, and not always recognize how those dynamics are going to work out. But I think things like this, things like they've talked about potentially collaborating on large body-on-frame SUVs for America, which I think makes a lot of sense, because both of these companies are in a really challenging spot. Japan and the US are their two most profitable, biggest markets, but also those are the markets that are less futuristic looking, less forward looking in terms of technology. And so we keep talking about the way the world's bifurcating into countries that are all in on the EV transition and companies that aren't, and or countries and that are and countries that aren't. And I think this is them saying, like, okay, we are two of Japan's strongest automakers, but we're still struggling in this new environment and we need to come together.
All right, let's move on. We have more on EV batteries and how they age. This is something that I'm really interested in, something that people seem to be really concerned about. Like the surveys, you know, the surveys of potential EV buyers used to be all about range anxiety, charging anxiety, where am I going to find a charger, yada, yada. And increasingly, these concerns around battery longevity, battery replacements, this is stuff that is bubbling up as a factor that is keeping people out of EVs. And if you're a longtime EV driver, like a lot of the people listening to this show, you probably already know that a lot of these fears are relatively unfounded unless you're driving like an early Nissan Leaf. But now we have this really gigantic study that proves again that EV batteries really do hold up just fine over tens of thousands of miles. The study comes from Avilu, which is a battery diagnostics company. They compiled the results of 500,000 battery health checks that happened from 2022 to 2026. They actually use, you know, like an OBD dongle, and they plug it in and they read how much capacity is left in the battery compared to how much was usable when it was new. And they focused on 20 popular models like the Tesla Model Y, Hyundai Ioniq 5, and they basically reported what the capacity looked like at three different milestones: 50,000 kilometers, 100,000 kilometers, and 150,000 kilometers. That's about 31,000 miles, 62,000 miles, and 93,000 miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the takeaway?
The takeaway is, well, we'll start with the winner. The winner seems to be the Hyundai Ioniq 5. It held up best at 50,000 kilometers and 100,000 kilometers. It basically tied for first. It was slightly edged out by the Mercedes EQA at the longer distance at 150,000 kilometers. What'd you say?
I just don't believe in that car. I don't know. Like, EQA, come on. Be serious. Don't waste my time with that.
But the result was really strong, like stronger than I expected. So at 150,000 kilometers, nearly 100,000 miles, they found that the Ioniq 5 on median had 94% of its battery capacity or range remaining, which is like, I mean, that kind of helps put it to bed, right?
Well, yeah. So where did everything else kind of end up?
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, so if you want to learn about all the different cars and across all these different mileages, go check out our story on InsideEVs.com. I'm going to focus on the top end, the 93,000 miles, because I think that's where most people, that's where the concerns start to set in, right? I don't think a lot of people are afraid that their car is going to be a brick at like 10 or 20,000 miles. So at 150,000 kilometers, the medians were basically between 90% and 94% capacity remaining for most models. The outliers were these smaller cars like the Mini Cooper SE, the Nissan Leaf, and the Renault Zoe, which all were in the high 80s, like 87%. But basically, at 150,000 kilometers, the median for all these cars was between 87% and 94%, which feels really solid to me.
Yeah. And just to call it out, because it's something we talk about a lot, the Leaf and the Zoe are two of the only EVs in modern history to come with air-cooled batteries from the factory, so that we know those degrade quickly. We've written about that before. Yeah. And so hearing that number for the rest of it, I mean, that's a pretty good sounding number. So, you know, I would guess at this point, though, a lot of people are wondering, okay, we talked about Ioniq 5, we talked about Leaf. The one you got to talk about, where the Teslas rank.
Right, right. And just one quick note on the smaller cars. Avi Liu also said that, and this makes perfect sense, they called out that smaller cars, cars with smaller batteries, need more charging cycles to rack up those miles. And that contributes to their faster degradation. Tesla was like toward the middle slash bottom of the pack, depending on what mileage you're looking at and what car you're looking at. They tested the Model 3 and the Model Y were both in this study. And after 150,000 kilometers, Model Ys were at a median health of 90.3%. which is toward the bottom of like where we saw most of the cars land up, better than those small cars, but worse than something like the Ioniq 5. Model 3 was at 88.9%, which again is good but not great in this in the confines of this study.
Yeah. Yeah, and that kind of tracks with something I've heard from automakers and wasn't sure whether or not to trust, which is that legacy automakers are more conservative with the buffers they put at the top of the battery to make sure that you're not actually charging to 100%, whereas Tesla's approach is a little more you get to make that decision. And those are two different approaches. And it just depends on what you prefer. If you need to use that 100% often and you want to use all the battery, you paid for it, you know, that's your move. But I think the rest of this really just confirms what I already suspected, which is just, I'm not worried about it at all. Like less than 10% and basically 100,000 miles. Like, yeah, that's kind of table stakes. And most importantly, and something we need to stress every time we talk about this, is that degradation is steepest early on, right? Mm-hmm. And so obviously, if you've only lost 10% in the first 90,000 miles, you're probably not going to lose another 10% over the next 90,000 miles.
Right.
Although, and this is the big caveat with all of these tests, is calendar aging and mileage aging, they both matter. Cycles matter. The amount of time that the car is just exists matters. The amount of time it sits at high energy, the charge rate, all of these things matter. And people always ask, should I not let it sit at 80%? Should I not do this? Should I not do that? And I think what a grand study of a lot of cars is showing is that generally speaking, unless you're really outside the norm and you're leaving it at 100% for weeks and weeks and weeks and only fast charging and stuff, it just doesn't seem like it is enough of a problem that you should be drastically altering how you work, how you drive, anything like that to preserve your battery, because they just seem to be incredibly robust.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's interesting, though, like there is a range, right? And I think one of the best parts of this study is that they don't just say, they don't just show the median for each car. They show a range of battery capacities at that mileage that should encompass 99% of examples. And it actually can be quite wide. I think still the takeaway is that even at the low end, a lot of these cars are still holding up pretty darn well. And at the high end, it's like quite astonishing how much capacity they can hold on to after like almost 100,000 miles. But the range of outcomes is quite broad. So like if you're shopping for a car, if somebody left it at 100% constantly, it might be 10%. It might have 10% less range than a car with the same amount of miles that was treated better. As an example, Ioniq 5 at 150,000 kilometers, the range was 86.7% to almost 98%. So the best examples will be basically brand new, and some of the worst examples will have about 13% battery degradation. For the Mustang Mach-E, 85% to 96%, Model Y, 83% to 95%. So yeah, like these are still pretty good results, but if you're buying a car, don't be surprised if it's less or more than, you know, the average.
Right. And the reason I was saying not to stress the behavior all that much is what you're saying is the lowest score in 90,000 miles or the, 99% confidence interval is about 10% lower than the highest possible score.
Yeah.
So if you assume the average person lands somewhere in the middle, I'm just saying that like that extra fast charging trip that like once a month that you got to charge to 100%, it
definitely
just doesn't seem like that's
going
to, you know, you might give up 5 miles over 5 years. All right. You know, I think about it just in the context of my car, had about 280 miles of range from the factory. And so 90,000 miles down, depending on how I charge it, am I going to be at 85 or 95% battery? Probably somewhere in the middle. But yeah, I typically slow charge. I, you know, sometimes do charge to 100% just because it's level one charging. So it's just a matter of sometimes it's useful to just leave it plugged in so I don't have to haul the extension cord out and all these things. But when I got my car, I didn't even get a battery test because I'm just like, my thing is predominantly level one charged. I'm more worried about calendar aging than I am about mileage because I don't drive that much in a given year. But I thought about doing the whole thing and trying to get independent battery tests and all these things. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I just know my car is going to last for at least 10 years. And, you know, and then beyond that, we'll see. But I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think you should be. Let's move on to Plus Minus, the segment of the show where we talk about who's up and who's down this week in the EV world. Mac, who you got?
Yeah. So my plus this week is Waymo expanding to new cities. So they announced this week that they're starting operations in three cities, or commercial operations, I should say, in Denver, Tampa, and San Diego. A couple important notes there. First, I live in San Diego, so I'm just happy about that. It's only invite only now, but I imagine within a couple of months it'll be open to everyone. And I see them all the time driving around.
I have a feeling
and-
you could get on if you... I have a feeling you could use your juice to get on the list.
Yeah, I tried once. We'll see. But that was before there was a list. So
yeah.
And someone from Waymo just reached out and said they liked a story I wrote. So I'll be like, hey, hook me up. But anyway, the bigger news that's more relevant to other people and not just me not wanting to get car sick and Ubers is that Denver is the first city that they're starting commercial service in that regularly experiences significant amounts of snow. And I think that's just a huge step change. That is something they've announced they want to come to Detroit. They were originally going to come to New York City, although the city officials or state officials put a kibosh on that. So that's not happening. But this is the year, this is the winter, where we're going to see Waymo's operational in the snow. We've already seen them test in the snow in places like Novi, Michigan, Buffalo, New York. But I think this is super interesting and promising in that, you know, snow is, I would say, an order of magnitude more difficult to drive in than dry pavement. It's just the level to which it impedes your grip, your visibility. I don't even think the average human driver really understands how drastic it is or how to navigate it safely. And so I think this is an area where robotic precision, LiDAR seeing through smoke and, you know, or not smoke, snow and clouds and all that stuff, all of that's going to be really helpful. And if they can nail this, this is where I think the huge unlock in terms of safety and, you know, fatalities goes down if we could get these things working in all weather. So I'm excited to see them try that. It's going to be a while before it's, I don't think they'll be running in like the peak of snowstorms, like when there's mm-hmm. floods in Miami, they tend to shut it down as well. But I think this is just going to be a really interesting year for seeing that.
Yeah. New test for Waymo. It means they're now in 14 cities, albeit like these new ones just kind of starting to ramp up, but 14 cities where you can hail a driverless Waymo. My plus is Norway. Speaking of countries where they're all in on electrification. Yep. EVs hit 98.7% market share in Norway in August. That's a record. It was at about 96% share in all of 2025, and it's still climbing. Shows what happens when you make EVs cheaper, when you have a really consistent policy around like pushing EVs and trying to get people, and when you have a vast amount of like oil wealth to do that. Top brands in Norway, in case you're curious, in the EV capital of the world. Last month, Volkswagen, Toyota, BMW, Volvo, and then the fifth place was kind of a wild card for me, XPeng. Both XPeng and BYD are making big inroads into Norway as of late.
Wow. Yeah, and I see in August, Norwegians bought just 30 gas cars. And I just can't wait until we finally get the version of this podcast where we interview the last guy who buys a gas car in Norway.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely should. Yeah. Norwegians bought just 30 gas cars, making up 0.2% of the market, 31 hybrids and 45 plug-in hybrids. So the gas cars are not doing great in Norway.
Yeah, yikes.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show is produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.